From the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the University of Missouri, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Most people don't think of slavery as a 21st century problem. But when it comes to imported seafood you've bought at your local supermarket, there's a chance it was caught or processed by slave labor in the fishing industry in Southeast Asia. Take the Thai seafood export industry, for example. It's the third largest in the world, worth $7 billion a year. A large portion of its seafood is being caught by slaves, either laborers tricked into working for a company after being promised lucrative jobs, or kidnapped and forced to work to pay off an imaginary debt. Recently, the Thai government adopted laws that banned illegal fishing and child labor and started tracking fishing vessels through a registration system. But corruption and human trafficking is still thought to be common in the industry. On this edition of Global Journalist, a look at slavery at sea in Southeast Asia and what's being done to fight it. Joining us first is a reporter from the Associated Press who shared a Pulitzer Prize this year for the news agency's remarkable reporting on this subject. Margie Mason is the AP's Asia regional writer in Jakarta, Indonesia. Margie, welcome to Global Journalist.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Tell us just a little bit about how you heard about this issue initially and how you came to report on it.
Well, I think labor abuses in the Southeast Asia fishing industry have long been an open secret. Other journalists have written bits and pieces of it, but I think that myself and initially my colleague Robin McDowell, we wondered why no one really seemed to care about this and why there wasn't any real outrage. And when we heard that the numbers of stranded and victimized foreign fishermen in Indonesia had been going up over the past few years, we decided that we wanted to look at it, but we wanted to take a very comprehensive look. So two of our goals from the beginning, we wanted to try to find fishermen who were still being held captive or were enslaved in some way. And we also wanted to trace their catch back to American grocery stores and restaurants and dinner tables. And we knew that that was a pretty lofty goal, and we were told repeatedly that this would be something very difficult, if not impossible, to do. But we were determined, and we had a lot of determination to see this through.
And you did just a huge amount of reporting on this issue. Give us just an overview of what you found.
Well, the biggest thing we found, our reporting led us to an island village in remote eastern Indonesia called Benjina. And we were not expecting to find a slave island, but that's basically what it was. We found men in a cage. We found a graveyard with nearly 70 markers, all of them with fake names and addresses, and people with the wrong nationalities. Most of them were Burmese, buried in those graves, but they were buried under Thai nationalities. The conditions were brutal. The men told us stories of, not being fed much and not being paid for, sometimes years. Some of the men had been on this island for decades, actually.
And where are these men coming from that were trapped on this Indonesian slave island?
Many of them were from Myanmar. But all of the men that we met were coming to Thailand looking for jobs. So you have men from Cambodia and from Laos and from poor parts of Thailand as well. And they were being oftentimes tricked or in some cases even drugged and put on boats and trafficked then on Thai boats to Indonesian waters where they were catching fish that was then being transported back to Thailand for export.
And these Thai companies that are holding the men hostage, how did they react to your visiting this slave island?
I think that initially when we went to the island, we tried to not interact a whole lot with the captains, and we really tried to engage the men and not talk to the captains and people who obviously would not have appreciated us asking a lot of questions about their business. But then, of course, some of the businesses in Thailand were very upset. And then others in Thailand were quite responsive and saw this as an opportunity to try to address this longstanding issue.
And so if I understand you correctly, these men, mostly from Myanmar, were being held on this slave island, and then periodically they were being sent out to sea on Thai fishing boats to work for effectively nothing for very long hours. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
And can you tell us just a little bit about the rescue operation? I understand that after you began reporting this, the Indonesian Navy actually took action.
Actually, it was the Indonesian Fisheries Ministry. And about a week and a half or so after our first story came out, the Indonesian Fisheries Minister sent a task force to Benjina and to some of the other islands to see what was taking place there. And when they got to Benjina and they saw that the situation was as bad as we said it was, they immediately, spontaneously actually, started filling, I believe it was three of the boats, the trawlers that the men had once worked on. They filled them up and they took them off to another island in the Moluccas, where the men were then able to stay at a makeshift camp until they got their documentation to go home. But I will add that all of those men from Benjina left without getting any compensation, and they still have not been compensated for any of the work that they did.
And so what was the reaction of the people who were enslaved on this island when they saw this Thai fishing ministry boat come when you were there?
Well, it was an Indonesian ministry fishing boat. The Thais were not involved in any way with this rescue. But they obviously were overjoyed when they when the word started to spread. The men ran. Some of them were hiding in the jungles or in the hills surrounding the area. They ran and they leaped into their boats and they grabbed whatever meager belongings they had and put them in plastic bags and raced back to be counted because they didn't want to be left behind. And so it was, you know, for many of them, the rain was pouring down at the time, and many of them were overjoyed at the moment.
And one thing that was compelling about your reporting was that you were able to follow some of these men all the way back to their homes in Myanmar. Tell us just, can you give us just one of those stories?
I followed a man who had been trafficked to Indonesia, and he had been here for 22 years, since 1993. And he had had no contact with any of his relatives back home since that time. And I followed him back to Myanmar and back to his village. And we witnessed the reunion with his mother and his sister, which was incredibly dramatic. He collapsed basically onto the road and was just completely overcome by emotions. And then his mother, you know, kind of came along and gathered him up and cradled him in his arms, and you know, they wept together, and it was a bittersweet moment because obviously he was happy to be home with his family, but so many years had been lost to this trafficking.
And our time does grow short, Margie, but another part of your investigation was tracking the seafood that was caught through slave labor back to supermarkets in the U.S. like Walmart and Kroger or restaurant distributor Sysco. How did you do that?
When we, Robin McDowell and Esther Toussaint were on the island, they watched the slave-caught fish being loaded onto a refrigerated cargo ship, a Thai ship. And then using satellites, we watched that reefer ship make its way to Samutsakon, Thailand. And then we flew there and watched, you know, behind tinted windows in the backs of trucks over four nights, this fish being unloaded and distributed throughout the city to different businesses. And from there, we use U.S. custom records to connect the dots back to the U.S.
Margie Mason, thanks so much for joining us on Global Journalist.
Thank you.
A reminder that you're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week, we tackle the issue of slavery in the seafood industry and how some fish sold in supermarkets in Europe and the U.S. has been caught or processed by slave laborers in Southeast Asia. To broaden our discussion, we're going to bring in three additional guests now. Joining us from Washington, D.C., Matthew Smith, the executive director of Fortify Rights, a human rights organization working in Southeast Asia. From Bangkok, Lisa Rende-Taylor, executive director of the SARA Institute, an NGO aimed at stopping human trafficking. And from Kuala Lumpur, Hoa Win, an international consultant who has previously worked with the UN and other agencies on human trafficking issues. Lisa Rende-Taylor, welcome to Global Journalist. From an economic perspective, can you tell us why slavery is so common in this industry, and is it still happening even after all this publicity?
I think that the nature of the problem in this industry and just the complexity and size of the industry, it's a problem that is not going to be solved overnight, even with the incredible reporting of AP and the work of a lot of other organizations leading up to it. The supply chain, all of the workers, the fishing boats, the feed mills, the processing plants, there's actually a lot of workers and a lot of steps that products go through in order to end up on U.S. supermarket shelves. And what that basically means is that there are hundreds, thousands of workers in dozens or possibly hundreds of workplaces where we have a difficulty to understand what is the situation, what is the labor situation that they're in. And as Marjorie explained earlier, a lot of these workers are from, coming from the neighboring countries, Myanmar, Laos, Cambodia, coming into Thailand, seeking a better life for themselves and their families, but there is not a very strong protective system for them to be able to be properly registered and exist legally in the country and to be able to do their work day to day and be paid properly. And so as a result, you basically have, these export-oriented industries where the bottoms of these supply chains are in, countries like Thailand and others in Southeast Asia, where these broken labor recruitment systems and all of this work, laws that are not being upheld, create an environment where you have lots of workers in lots of far-flung places across these countries that are creating products that do end up being exported into U.S. supermarket shelves.
Well, let me turn that to Matthew Smith. Tell us just a little bit about these human trafficking organizations. Who exactly is capturing these people and forcing them into slavery?
Yeah, sure. I would agree with Lisa that this can't be solved overnight. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. In terms of the way the trafficking happens, we're talking about individuals being controlled through deception, force, fraud, and essentially being exploited. And that can happen in a number of ways, and it's happened through a number of different organizations, we can say. In some cases, you have people who would be considered brokers who are selling individuals, in effect, to Thai fishing boat captains. You've also got, in some cases, we've documented people, refugees who were in detention in Thailand, who were then handed over by Thai officials to essentially human trafficking syndicates, who in turn have sold people onto fishing boats. So this is another way that it happens. But there are also these transnational criminal syndicates, and we're talking about individuals from many of the Southeast Asian nations banding together in what is essentially acts of organized crime, and there's a very ruthless economics to this trade, and we have interviewed some of the human traffickers as well in Thailand and in Malaysia. Many of them are still roaming free. They're not being prosecuted. They have no fear of justice knocking on their door. So there's still a great deal of work to be done.
And Hoa, when you've worked frequently with people who have been freed or escaped from essentially slavery in the seafood industry, what is the impact on the people that have done this work in incredibly difficult conditions?
Generally, just try to partnership and coordinating with government agency, local authority, and NGO. And I agree with Lisa and Matthew that it's extremely difficult work, and victims often do not trust the authority or the people who are trying to help them, because there's so much happened to them, and the traumatic experience from being trafficked, from being controlled and exploited, it's really damaged to them and take a lot of time to able to try to understand and offer the service and ensure that they assess the quality of service to them to able to, recover from what have been happened to them or come back to their origin safety.
And Lisa Rende-Taylor, we heard Matthew and Hoa as well talking about the involvement of local authorities in Thailand to some extent in this trade. What is the most effective way to put pressure on the Thai government to stop this?
Actually, it's kind of an interesting question, because the way that we work is not necessarily trying to put pressure on the government to strengthen their regulatory mechanisms and criminal justice process. That work all around the world in developing countries takes a long time. And we're talking about a situation where there's about 4 million migrant workers in Thailand, over 500,000 estimated trafficking victims in Thailand alone. So we feel like there needs to be a more prompt, a more rapid and nimble response to that. So actually we work through working with businesses, working with these global brands and retailers, like some that you've mentioned before in the United States and elsewhere, to for them to put pressure on the local Thai businesses who are in their supply chain to essentially clean up their act or possibly get cut from their supply chain. We've found that by far that is the not only the fastest way to bring about change on the ground, but also a way to sort of maybe catch the attention of the government and other stakeholders, and for them to see that actually there is a way to improve, even when the environment is so complex and rife with corruption and entrenched criminal networks that have been there for sometimes decades.
And Matthew Smith, the market for the seafood is the United States and the European Union. What have they done to attempt to address this?
Well, the U.S. Issues an annual trafficking in persons report and essentially has a three-tier grading system. And Thailand is currently at the lowest tier, tier three. And it's interesting because the authorities, no government around the world wants to be ranked tier three at the lowest level. And we've noted that this type of pressure on the Thai authorities actually has spurred some interest from the highest levels of government in Thailand. So there are people who are you've got two camps of people essentially. You've got officials in Thailand who are working very hard to try to improve the situation in Thailand. Then you've got others who are still in denial. They think that this is all a conspiracy against Thailand. Other countries we've noted the same thing. So this type of pressure, I think, is important. And, you know, there are a lot of tools in the toolbox. And I think with these types of abuses, we have to use every tool that's available. And with respect to the U.S., consumers can play an enormous role as well. Consumers are ultimately buying these products. So all of this type of pressure combined, I think, will ultimately lead to change. And again, hats off to the AP team. Their work was absolutely essential in raising awareness about the problem.
A reminder that this is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week we tackle the issue of slave labor in the seafood industry in Southeast Asia. Joining us from Washington, D.C., Matthew Smith, the Executive Director of Fortify Rights. From Bangkok, Thailand, Lisa Rende Taylor, Executive Director of the Isara Institute, an anti-human trafficking NGO. And from Kuala Lumpur, Hoa Nguyen, a consultant on human trafficking issues. If you're interested in more Global Journalist content, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can read our ongoing series of interviews with journalists in exile around the world and coverage of foreign affairs and press freedom issues. We're also on social media. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at GlobalJourn. Hoa Nguyen, tell us a little bit about the reaction of local people in Thailand, in Indonesia, to this trade, because the scale of it is so massive. Lisa Rende Taylor was talking about 500,000 people being trafficked through Thailand alone, that it must be very visible to people on the ground there.
Yes, the community where I work most in Thailand and Indonesia, they are knowing about USU, and they try to help the victim, particularly with the NGO, the civil society organization. But for the government, still too far. I mean, some of the victims identify at the hotspot. They're very poor service there. No shelter or all sort of the problem that victim end up to be back to their beam and the recruitment, the bad people, trafficker. So very high risk for them, and even for the people who are try to, got help and come back to their origin, still in high risk that the trafficker try to bring them back to pay off their debt, and all this problem with, like, if they leave their origin for a long time, they got this rejection from the community or the family, and it's high risk for them again to be come back to the trafficker and trafficking. Appear in this case.
And Lisa Rende Taylor, what can Western consumers do to try to affect this issue? If you buy a can of cat food, if you buy frozen shrimp at the supermarket, how do you know if it was caught or processed by people who are slaves?
This is the key question for these labor issues. At this point, consumers don't have a way to be able to distinguish if the shrimp that they find, for example, in their supermarket freezer has been slave tainted or not. There is no distinguishing mark. There's very little that they can do. Because I think the vast majority of the supermarkets in the US and around the world basically rely on kind of this, you know, audit compliance system where once in a while some of their suppliers are audited to see if, you know, the conditions are okay with regards to health and safety and environment and, you know, labor and all these different sorts of issues. But it's like a needle in a haystack because, as I, you know, was explaining before, it's a very kind of long and complex supply chain that takes products from the fishing boat to U.S. supermarket shelves. There's actually an awful lot of different workplaces and hundreds of thousands of workers that you have to be concerned about. I think that the one thing that we would say is that when you hear this kind of news, for example, you know, shrimp in Thailand is slave tainted, I guess we would say, don't pull out, don't boycott, you know, Thailand or Thai shrimp, because it's not as if every single, you know, producer of these products is a bad person or is a bad business. There are a lot of folks, as Margie was mentioning earlier, who have been quite responsive to the issue. They want to make their workplaces better. There's a lot of, you know, focus on Thailand and the seafood industry, and there's a lot of opportunities and signs of change, where in many other countries, it's not like the risks aren't, I mean, there are risks that are inherent to the fishing industry. The attention is not on them. And so to pull out of Thailand and perhaps to buy from somewhere else is not necessarily evading the slavery issue when talking about these very hazardous industries. So for us, I guess we would say, don't necessarily stop purchasing products that are, you know, these products that are highlighted in the media from these countries. But hopefully you're buying from supermarkets who have policies that they are advertising for actively trying to work to ensure that they are working with non-slave tainted goods. They're working on, you know, worker voice and empowerment. They're doing a bit more, going the extra mile. And all of these things have to be basically advertised publicly, at least in the United States, according to the California Transparency and Supply Chains Act. It says that companies have to go and at least announce online what their policies are about dealing with trafficking in their supply chain. So consumers can at least go to understand how their supermarket is dealing with these matters. So product by product, we're not there yet, unfortunately. We are working on these issues, and, you know, NGOs around the world. But in the meantime, I think we can at least understand how seriously some of our supermarkets are taking the slavery issue.
And Matthew Smith, Lisa Rende-Taylor, says that not all shrimp, not all seafood from Thailand is tainted by the slavery industry. Do we have a sense as to the scale of it? Because the Associated Press alone, a handful of reporters talked to something like 300 ex-slaves on this one island they visited in Indonesia. There were literally dozens of people running out of the jungle to be freed. So do we know, is it 1% of the Thai seafood industry or 30% of the Thai seafood industry that's impacted by this?
Well, we don't have any concrete data on that, and I think it would be very difficult to make those estimations right now. You know, we're talking about an industry where there are anywhere between 600,000 and 700,000 laborers. Up to 90% of them are coming from other countries. This is an industry that has been beset by slavery, human trafficking, labor rights violations for many, many years. We wouldn't go so far as to say that the entire industry, you know, that Thailand's entire $7 billion industry is directly associated with slave labor. And as Lisa said, there are good actors. There are companies that are trying to do the right thing. So it is sensible to be as discerning as possible when we're taking a closer look at this. You know, without having any sort of concrete estimate, it's difficult to say what percentage of the sector. But
Matthew, I could stop you just for a moment, because I did want to ask you about this Thai government agency that has been set up to investigate this issue. We did contact them to invite them on the show. Unfortunately, they didn't respond to us, nor did the Thai Frozen Seafood Association, a trade industry group. Can you tell us about how effective the regulatory mechanisms have been from the Thai government? Have they been going out and prosecuting people involved in this trade since all this publicity?
Well, there have been. We saw traceability and monitoring mechanisms implemented recently, or passed, I should say. The implementation is what's key. So we have to be sure that these things will be these tools will be implemented. And as of right now, there's still forced labor in the seafood sector, and there's still illegal fishing taking place, which is contributing to this phenomenon. In terms of prosecutions, Thailand right now is undergoing its largest trial, human trafficking trial. There are 92 defendants. This is not directly related to slavery in the seafood sector, but it is in some ways tangentially related. There are 92 defendants, including government officials, being prosecuted for trafficking Rohingya Muslims from Myanmar and Bangladeshi nationals. There are some serious problems with that trial. Witnesses have been threatened, have gone into hiding. The chief investigator is actually seeking asylum in Australia now. He's a police officer who's seeking asylum in another country because he feared for his life, because he was uncovering information about these trafficking syndicates and the role of Thai authorities. So we have seen some positive behavior from the authorities. There are certainly some actors who are trying to do the right thing, but as of right now, there is a tremendous amount of work to do for Thailand to end this abhorrent practice of slavery and human trafficking.
And Hoa, when our time does grow short, do you see the situation improving in this industry since there has been all this attention focused on it by the AP and other news agencies?
Yes, definitely. I see the particular Thai government start to open up a bit about how they could improve their witness protection or victim protection, and also the involvement of the authority in trying to listen to the victim and try to insert more program and training more officers to aware of all this policy and how to implement it to improve condition and to reduce the illegal migrant forced labor and exploitation and the trafficking in the country.
And Lisa Rende Taylor, what do you think this situation will look like 3 years from now?
I think that all of my colleagues have already mentioned it's a big problem. There's a lot of work to do. Luckily, there's a lot of tools in our arsenal, a lot of ways to go about doing it. And I mean, some of it is dependent on the political will within the government to uphold the law. Some of it is going to be up to businesses to tolerance policies against forced labor and slavery, and the different mechanisms and leverages that exist within, you know, within global supply chains of discerning customers and discerning buyers and suppliers who want to, you know, maintain their customer base. And so between these, let's hope that the awareness continues at the levels that are required to continue to put pressure and encouragement on, like, in having, you know, this two-pronged approach lead to some, you know, successes that really kind of impact and better the lives of all these thousands of migrant workers in this vulnerable industry.
That's going to have to do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the University of Missouri. Many thanks to Margie Mason, Matthew Smith, Lisa Rende Taylor, and Hoa Nguyen for joining us. Our executive producer is Joshua Kranzberg. Our supervising producer this week is Lakshana Mehta, with associate producers Riley Begin, Li Ying Kwan, and Louise Hemmerlin. Our studio director is Travis McMillan of RJI. Our audio engineer is Kyle Felling of KBIA. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for joining us.